John Forrest. Here on Radio 4 FM, it's still winter. Kafka is troubled. Not for the first time, Duchamp makes an impact, and realism is on the back foot in our Book of the Week, 1913, by Florian Illies. A snapshot of Europe in the year before the war, using biographical extracts and contemporary news items.
Vienna has become a world city, and this can be felt everywhere except in Vienna itself, where people haven't realized that they have unexpectedly moved to the apex of the movement which calls itself modernism. Its star players include Sigmund Freud, Arthur Schnitzler, Egon Schiele, Gustav Klimt, Adolf Loos, Arnold Schoenberg, and Oskar Kokoschka. Here the battles rage about the unconscious, about dreams, the new music, the new way of seeing, the new architecture, the new logic, the new morality. At Klimt and Schiele's studios, their drawings, whose lines teeter so sensually between pornography and the so-called new objectivity, delineate the curves of the most erotic city in the world, as Lou Andreas Salome declared Vienna to be. Where Klimt's work reveals soft skin, Schiele shows nerves and sinews. Where Klimt's bodies flow, Schiele's splay, entangle and contort. Klimt's women lure, while Schiele's shock. These drawings are soon subjected to censorship, thereby increasing the notoriety of their creators. When Schiele wants to exhibit his work in Munich, he receives an interesting rejection letter. The director of the gallery writes to inform him that his work could not be shown under any circumstances because of its extreme nature. Full stop. New paragraph. He, however, would be very interested in purchasing the work. On the 17th of February, the Armory Show, one of the most important art exhibitions of the century, opens in a former arsenal in New York. In total, there are 1,300 paintings on display, only a third of them from Europe. But it is this third that makes the American pictures look ancient. The greatest sensation is caused by the three brothers, Raymond Duchamp-Villon, Jacques Villon, and Marcel Duchamp. 17 of their works are exhibited, and all but one is sold. Marcel Duchamp's Nude Descending a Staircase becomes the focal point, the most discussed and most caricatured artwork on show. A woman striding through space and time, a combination of cubism, futurism, and relativity theory. The room housing the picture is flooded with visitors every single day. People queue for over 40 minutes just to catch a glimpse of the scandalous painting. Evidently, for the traditionally minded Americans, this work is the embodiment of a strange, irrational Europe. The Duchamps go on working away in their studio in Neuilly, oblivious to their newfound American fame, until the checks suddenly start coming in the post. Marcel Duchamp receives $972 for his four sales, not a high price even in 1913. Cézanne's La Colline des Pauvres, for example, sells from the exhibition to the Metropolitan Museum for $6,700. Duchamp is pleased nonetheless. But at the moment when America and Paris too start to pay attention to his work, Marcel Duchamp turns his back on cubism and the theme of motion, or as he puts it, motion mixed with oil paint. At the very moment when he should become one of the greatest artists of his generation, Duchamp declares that he is bored with painting.
He is looking for something new.
Charles Fabry successfully concludes a series of experiments culminating in the discovery of the ozone layer. it is still fully intact. In Prague, Franz Kafka is suffering. He's suffering because Felis, for whom he has been pining from afar in letters, hasn't said a word about the book Contemplations, which he sent her in December. And because his sister Vali is getting married, and because it's always too noisy in the apartment, and because he's working for an insurance company by day and writing by night. But above all, he's suffering from the fear that his creativity has withered away. And as dreadful as the idea of living as a bachelor is, perhaps it is the only way of being a writer. In moments of panic, he is overwhelmed by the question, what will become of me if I get married? How would he deal with what he called a wife's rights? For him, there are two equally horrific scenarios, the physical demands of the wife, and above all, the demands on his time. He implores Phyllis never again to write that she wants to sit by him while he's working on his books, for if she or anyone else were to sit behind him, the secret of writing would be destroyed. And then he also writes, I would never expose myself to the risk of becoming a father. Is it possible to warn someone off more than Kafka did in these letters? Albert Einstein, also in Prague, is becoming increasingly remote from his wife Mileva. He stops telling her about his research, his discoveries, his concerns, and she says nothing and puts up with it. In the evening, Einstein goes to coffee houses or bars all by himself and drinks a beer. Kafka might be sitting at the next table, but they don't know each other. And then, in March, just like Kafka, Einstein writes long letters to Berlin. On a visit to the city, he has fallen in love with his recently divorced cousin, Elsa. He writes terrible things about his marriage. He and Mileva no longer sleep in the same room. He avoids being alone with her under all circumstances. She is an unfriendly, humorless creature. And he treats her like an employee whom, regrettably, he is unable to fire. Then he puts the letter in an envelope, and off he goes to the post office. And so Einstein and Kafka's epistolary laments travel, presumably in the same post bag, from Prague to Berlin, to the far-off women of their dreams, Phyllis and Elsa. The industrialist Walter Rathenau recognizes the economic challenge represented by the United States and sketches the picture of a peaceful European Union with close ties. One last possibility remains, he says, the emergence of a central European tariff union. The task of creating the freedom of economic movement for the countries in our European zone is difficult, but not insoluble. In Sindelsdorf, Bavaria, Franz Marc is back to work on his masterpiece. He has set up his studio in the unheated attic of an old farmhouse, from where he can barely hear Maria Marc playing the piano downstairs. It's so cold that even Hanni, their beloved cat, retreats to the stove. Kandinsky comes to visit from Munich and reports, outside everything is white. Snow covers the fields, the mountains, the forests.
Der Turm der Blauen Pferde, the Tower of Blue Horses, is perched on the easel. And Franz Marc stands there in his fur coat, a big fur hat and straw shoes that he made himself. Now, he says, tell me in all honesty what you make of this picture.
A Art everywhere is driving towards abstraction. Kandinsky in Munich, Robert Delaunay and František Kupka in Paris, Kazimir Malevich in Russia, and Piet Mondrian in the Netherlands. Each in their own way, they are trying to free themselves from all reference to reality. Albert Schweitzer is in Strasbourg, working on his third doctorate. He has already been a doctor of philosophy for some time, ever since completing his philosophical dissertation, The Religious Philosophy of Kant, From the Critique of Pure Reason to Religion Within the Boundaries of Mere Reason. He's a doctor of theology, too. The Problem of the Last Supper, a study based on the scientific research of the 19th century and the historical accounts. After becoming a lecturer in theology and even vicar of the Church of St. Nikolai, he decides to become a doctor of medicine as well, receiving his license to practice in 1912. But doctor and vicar and lecturer aren't enough. Another thesis, The Psychiatric Study of Jesus, has yet to be completed. To make sure he doesn't fall asleep while reading, he develops the habit of putting a bucket of cold water under his desk. When he can't follow the explanations in the books anymore, he takes off his socks, puts his feet in cold water, then goes on reading. Vienna is only a day's train ride away from the Austrian crown land of Galicia, and that's why it has become the most popular political exile for refugee revolutionaries from Russia. In the Döblinger Rodlergasse, for example, is the writer and journalist Leo Bronstein, better known as Leo Trotsky. Trotsky earns very little from his journalism for various liberal and social democratic pamphlets, and often spends entire days sitting in the Café Central playing chess. Herr Bronstein is regarded as the best chess player in the Viennese café scene, and that is saying something. Whenever he needs money, though, his only option is to take some of his books to the pawn shop. Stalin is still working on Marxism and the National Question, which is to become his most famous work. Stalin, Sosso to his friends, talks about nothing else. Two men visit him during his stay in the Troichanovsky residence in Vienna. To Stalin's delight, Nikolai Bukharin helps him with translations, and Trotsky drops by once. "I was sitting next to the samovar at the table," writes Trotsky, "when, after a brief knock, the door suddenly opened and a stranger walked in. He was short, thin, pockmarks covered his grey-brownish skin. I couldn't see even the slightest trace of friendliness in his eyes." He fetched himself a cup of tea from the samovar and went out as quietly as he had come in. In that same February, a man is born in faraway Barcelona who will later murder Trotsky on Stalin's orders. His name is Jaime Ramón Mercader del Río Hernández. There is still no sign of Leonardo's Mona Lisa. The Louvre's new catalogue is published, no longer listing the painting.
1913, the year before the storm, was written by Florian Illies, abridged by Pete Nichols, and read by Michael Maloney. The producer was Karen Rose, and it's a Sweet Talk production for BBC Radio 4. In Call You and Yours this lunchtime, Julia Warwicker asks, how happy are children in the UK today? A new report suggests their well-being may be in decline. Having interviewed 42,000 8 to 17-year-olds, it found that it's the 14 and 15-year-olds who are the least happy. Concern about school, unhappiness with their appearance, and a lack of freedom top the list of worries. But what can be done to make life easier and happier for young people? You can call You and Yours at midday.
In the first of a new series, Crossing Continents travels to Barcelona.
With this, I can't get past what somebody has taken from my body.
Two women from Africa await pioneering surgery.
If your family knew about this, what would they say?
They would say that I'm disobeying them and that I'm betraying them.
To give back something taken away in childhood.
What they recover is a Western feminine identity. In their countries, a woman must be mutilated to be a woman.
Crossing Continents returns this Thursday morning at 11 o'clock on BBC Radio 4.